Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide, eager to unpack the latest insights with you. Today, we're plunging into the pages of The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, August 23rd, 2025. Our mission is to navigate this treasure trove of information, pull out the most important nuggets, and explore what it all means for you.
And I'm Sam Astor, the expert, ready to connect the dots and provide some broader context to the stories that shape our world. Our goal is to move beyond just the headlines, helping you understand the underlying currents and the deep implications of what's happening.
Absolutely. Today's deep dive is truly a comprehensive look at the forces impacting our wallets, our communities, and even our daily habits. We've got a fascinating array of topics, from pivotal shifts in economic policy to high-stakes political maneuvers in Washington, to deeply personal stories about parenting, the future of technology, and even surprising trends in fashion and travel. So let's unpack this together and see what insights we can uncover. Kicking us off in a big way, let's talk about the Federal Reserve. It seems we're on the cusp of a significant shift with potential interest rate cuts on the horizon. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, in his widely watched address at the Jackson Hole Conference on Friday, August 22nd, really opened the door for potential cuts as early as next month, September 2025. What's the core driver behind this pivot?
Well, Alex, the primary justification seems to be a perceived softening in the labor market. Powell suggests this could be key in reining in inflation. You know, for the past year, the Fed had held rates steady, citing a robust labor market and, well, uncertainty surrounding the inflation outlook, especially given recent significant tariff hikes. So this move signals a notable departure from their previous policy. Remember, they tolerated inflation running moderately above its 2% target.
To compensate for earlier lags.
Exactly. They've basically retired that strategy. They've unveiled a new approach that rebalances how inflation and employment are weighed.
So a new framework is in play. But tariffs have been pushing prices up. How does Powell factor that into his thinking about future inflation?
That's a crucial point. Powell acknowledged that tariffs are indeed pushing up prices. But interestingly, he optimistically suggested these effects would be relatively short-lived and represent a, quote, one-time shift in the price level.
A one-time shift. That's a big assumption.
It is. It's a really significant assessment for market expectations of sustained rate cuts. If he believed tariff-driven inflation was more persistent, it would certainly, you know, complicate future decisions. He also hinted that the so-called neutral setting for interest rates, that's the theoretical level that neither stimulates nor slows economic activity, might be higher than it was in the last decade.
Interesting. So even with cuts, the baseline might be higher going forward.
Potentially, yes. It sets a potentially higher baseline for rates, even with cuts. The current benchmark rate is around 4.3%, just for context.
This sounds like quite a positive outlook from the Fed chair, relatively speaking. How did the markets react to this possibility of lower borrowing costs?
Oh, enthusiastically. The financial markets responded immediately. The Dow Jones Industrial Average soared over 800 points, which marked its first record close of 2025. And that ended a pretty prolonged streak without such a high.
Wow.
Yeah, the S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite also saw significant gains. This broad-based optimism clearly stems from the prospect of lower borrowing costs, which, you know, typically boost corporate profits and consumer spending. Looking ahead, investors will be watching the upcoming release of the Personal Consumption Expenditures, or PCE, price index very closely. That's the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, so they'll want confirmation of these trends.
So what does this pivotal shift mean for your adjustable rate mortgage or the interest you're earning on your savings? How might these changes impact the broader economic landscape you navigate every day?
Yep.
It's a direct connection to your personal bottom line, isn't it?
Absolutely. These aren't just abstract numbers.
Now, let's turn our attention to some, well, truly unprecedented economic interventions from the White House. President Trump has announced that the U.S. government is acquiring a 10% stake in Intel. Now, this deal isn't a traditional purchase. It stems from the conversion of $8.9 billion in grants from the 2022 CHIPS Act into equity. What does this signify about the government's role in private enterprise?
Well, it certainly raises an important question about the government's expanding role in private enterprise, especially in strategic sectors like chip manufacturing. While government apparently won't take a board seat, its financial stake creates a, well, complex dynamic. It definitely blurs the lines between state and industry. What's particularly fascinating here is that President Trump seems to view Intel's revitalization as crucial for his broader goal of resurrecting U.S. manufacturing. It makes the company almost a political project for his administration, you know, especially given Intel's recent struggles compared to competitors like NVIDIA and AMD.
It sounds like a highly targeted, almost, well, nationalistic industrial policy. I understand there were also some dramatic events leading up to this deal regarding Intel's CEO.
Indeed. The deal was preceded by what the journal calls a two-week frenzy for Intel. Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican from Arkansas, sent a letter raising concerns about CEO Tan's ties to China. That led to Trump's public call for Tan's ouster.
Wow.
Yeah. And this culminated in a White House meeting on August 11th. The $8.9 billion in grants that were converted to equity were, quote, not yet paid. And the agreement even allows for more government stock depending on how Intel's chip manufacturing business performs.
So that's not just a passive investment.
Not at all. It's a very active, hands-on intervention. It goes beyond just investment into really corporate governance influence.
So beyond the headlines, what does this level of government intervention mean for the free market? How might your investments in tech companies be affected by these kinds of strategic, politically driven deals? It certainly challenges conventional notions of corporate autonomy and, you know, the separation of state and industry.
It really does. Big questions.
Shifting our gaze across the Atlantic, let's look at Europe's economic landscape.
Yeah.
Despite facing new American trade tariffs, European business activity has shown some resilience, apparently. The Eurozone's Composite Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, slightly rose in August. That sounds okay on the surface, but what's the deeper insight here?
Well, that's the thing. What's fascinating here is that beneath that veneer of resilience lies a significant loss of economic dynamism and, frankly, military clout over the past 15 years. Germany, you know, Europe's largest economy, remains stagnant. Its economy is only 1% larger than it was at the end of 2017.
1%? Wow.
Yeah, compare that to the U.S.'s 19% growth over the same period. It's stark. The key insight, I think, is this. Europe faces a multifaceted crisis, its aging demographics colliding with economic stagnation. Their traditional welfare models are becoming unsustainable without a really radical shift towards market-driven growth and innovation.
That's a powerful summary. So how are these tariffs and competition impacting this already strained situation?
Well, the 15% tariffs that most EU manufacturers will now face on exports to the U.S. are expected to particularly hurt German manufacturers. They're already seeing declining exports and trade surpluses with the U.S. even in the first half of the year. Plus, you've got increased competition from Chinese manufacturers.
Right, because the U.S. tariffs push them elsewhere.
Exactly. Higher U.S. tariffs are forcing Chinese businesses to seek new markets, and that further threatens European jobs. It's a squeeze from multiple directions. It's pushing European companies like Huntsman Corp, a Texas-based chemicals manufacturer, actually, to reduce their European operations. They closed a German plant, citing high energy costs and red tape.
And the demographic picture you mentioned earlier sounds particularly grim.
It truly is. Europe faces a profound demographic crisis. The average age is nearly 45 compared to 39 in the U.S., and they're projecting a working age population decline of 50 million by 2050.
50 million?
Yeah. That puts immense pressure on their robust welfare states, which, get this, account for half the planet's welfare spending. Without significant spending cuts or a reignition of growth, Europe faces potential fiscal crises and political instability. The current strategy of financing welfare with high taxes, we're talking 38-44% of GDP compared to 25% in the U.S., and debt is becoming unsustainable.
It sounds like a critical juncture.
Yeah.
Proposed solutions like those from former Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi seem ambitious.
Yeah.
What are some of those ideas and their challenges?
Well, Draghi proposed things like pan-European capital, savings, and energy markets, reduce regulatory burdens, and massive public spending for innovation and defense. Immigration of high-skilled workers is another suggested solution, but Europe has really struggled here and faces a building political backlash against immigration. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz has also pledged an autumn of reforms, focusing on curbing welfare spending and digitizing administration. He even appointed someone to lead a new digitization ministry. But the political will and, you know, public consensus for such sweeping changes remain major challenges. As JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon starkly put it when he was in Dublin, quote, you're losing.
Oof. Tough words.
Very direct.
So if you were a European policymaker, how would you balance the need for economic growth with the demands of an aging population and a robust welfare state? What lessons might the U.S. draw from Europe's economic challenges? These are pressing questions that extend far beyond Europe's borders, really.
Absolutely. There are potential parallels and warnings there.
Let's turn to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, where we're seeing some complex diplomatic maneuvering. President Trump has initiated a two-step peace process. First, a meeting between Presidents Putin and Zelensky, followed by a three-way meeting including Trump himself. What's become a surprising central focus of this?
Well, what's truly fascinating here is how a key element has risen to the forefront of Trump's agenda, and it seems largely due to a months-long lobbying campaign. It's the plight of Ukraine's missing children.
The missing children.
Yes. Kyiv reports 20,000 children taken by Russian forces, many from orphanages and schools, with their identities potentially rewritten. The UN hasn't independently verified that number, but the claim itself is powerful. Apparently, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's meeting with Trump included powerful emotional appeals. He presented a photo and birth certificate of a toddler taken by Russian forces, even a golf club gifted by a wounded soldier.
Wow, very personal touches.
Exactly. Trump emphasized his humanitarian heart in seeking to end the war, and his administration has agreed to provide U.S. assistance for security assurances to enforce any peace agreement.
That's a powerful and deeply personal angle, and it seems to have had a significant impact.
Absolutely. The lobbying effort, which involved Ukrainian and European officials, but also evangelical Christian organizations like the Family Research Council, it proved incredibly effective in bringing the missing children issue to the forefront. This notably increased support for Ukraine among MAGA Republicans, showing how humanitarian concerns can, sometimes, transcend traditional political divides. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is now leading a multinational task force to address this very issue. He spoke about it publicly back in March.
So, while the immediate focus is on ending the conflict, Professor Stephen Kotkin offers a more nuanced perspective on what winning actually means here.
Indeed. Kotkin suggests that Trump's instinct to end the war is, quote, correct for Ukraine's sake, but he lacks follow-through and patience. The key insight from Kotkin is the importance of winning the peace over simply winning the war. Think Afghanistan, Vietnam.
Right. The aftermath.
Exactly. He argues, provocatively, that the return of Crimea to Ukraine is as likely as Texas going back to Mexico. He asserts it would only incentivize future Russian aggression and create a permanent insurgency within Ukraine because of its large ethnic Russian population.
Mm. So if NATO membership is unrealistic and regaining Crimea is unlikely, what does winning the peace look like for Ukraine, according to Kotkin?
For Kotkin, winning the peace might involve EU accession, using that process for domestic reforms, and what he calls a steel porcupine approach to security. This means fortifying Ukraine with robust domestic weapons production and European financing to make it, quote, undigestible for potential invaders.
Self-reliance, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. Building long-term self-reliant resilience rather than seeking external military guarantees. He also criticizes Biden's approach of endless and pointless support without a clear pathway for negotiations. And he emphasizes fostering alternatives to Putin's rule within Russia itself, noting widespread discontent, even citing increasing treason cases there.
This diplomacy is unfolding amidst mixed signals and escalation, though. We've seen Ukrainian drone and missile attacks on the Druzhba pipeline, the world's largest oil conduit, which carries crude to Germany, Slovakia, and Hungary. That caused quite a stir.
It did. And Trump's remark that it is very hard, if not impossible, to win a war without attacking the invader's country was echoed by Zelensky. Yet Trump's response to Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's outrage over these pipeline attacks was quite conciliatory. I am very angry about it. You are my great friend. That contrasts sharply with his administration's threats of sanctions against India for refining and reselling Russian oil, which Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent called profiteering.
Complex and sometimes contradictory signals, then.
Very much so. It highlights the challenges of navigating these geopolitical realities.
As citizens, how do you weigh the humanitarian imperative against geopolitical realities? What role should the U.S. play in brokering peace, and how might these strategic decisions affect global stability and human rights? It's a delicate balance with profound global consequences.
A very difficult tightrope to walk.
Moving to U.S. intelligence, we're seeing some significant turmoil. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth fired Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA, Director LT General Jeffrey A. Kruse. This marks the latest in a series of senior national security official dismissals by the Trump administration. What's the underlying concern here?
Well, this incident really highlights apparent pressure on intelligence agencies to align their assessments with the administration's public narrative. That potentially compromises the objectivity and independence of intelligence gathering, which is, fundamental. The firing reportedly followed a DIA evaluation of U.S. military strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities.
Right, the one that contradicted Trump's claims.
Exactly. It concluded the attack set back Tehran's program by only a few months, which directly contradicted President Trump's assertion of obliterating the sites. Hegseth had even publicly called the DIA assessment preliminary and of low confidence back in a June press conference.
This isn't an isolated incident either. There seems to be a pattern emerging.
That's right. The article notes Hegseth has a track record of firing numerous senior military officers, including 6 Air Force generals and the Navy's top-ranking officer, often without public explanation. Unquote. And this trend is further reinforced by Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard's actions. She removed National Intelligence Council officials who produced an assessment contradicting Trump's claims about the Venezuelan government directing the Tren de Aragua criminal gang to invade the U.S.
Mm.
Gabbard had previously spoken about deep state actors politicizing their positions, and her deputies actually directed the National Intelligence Council to rewrite that assessment back in May.
So what does it mean for your national security when intelligence assessments are perceived to be influenced by political agendas?
Mm.
How do you discern reliable information in such a polarized environment? These questions cut to the heart of trust in institutions vital for national security.
Yeah, it makes navigating the information landscape even trickier.
Shifting to domestic politics, President Trump's hardened border controls have dramatically reduced migrant encounters at the U.S.-Mexico border. The numbers are down 93% from a year ago. In July, there were approximately 7,800 encounters. On the surface, these numbers might suggest a successful policy, right? But what's the human cost of this approach?
The human cost is immense. That's the other side of the coin. This policy has effectively created what the Journal calls a Mexican nightmare for many migrants, leaving them stranded in Mexico and facing truly dire conditions. We're hearing harrowing stories of kidnapping and extortion by gang members, often posing as police.
Terrible.
Yeah, take the case mentioned of Cesar Atencio and Lena Arias from Colombia. They were kidnapped attempting to cross back in January after Trump won a second term.
Mm.
They were held for ransom in Mexico's Chihuahuan Desert. It's a chilling example of the desperation and danger migrants face. And Mexico's own support programs, like Mexico Embraces You, only help Mexican citizens deported from the U.S., leaving others reliant on charities.
It sounds like a humanitarian crisis unfolding just south of the border. And beyond that, what about the economic impact closer to home? In U.S. border towns.
Well, Trump's deportation agenda and tariffs are apparently creating economic hardship there, too. Small business owners report that immigration raids are scaring away clients, and Trump's rhetoric discourages cross-border shopping and services. For instance, the article mentions Iris Martinez, a client in a border town nail salon, expressing concern about the local economy, which the owner called worse than the pandemic. So it's a significant economic impact colliding directly with enforcement efforts.
What's also fascinating is how this is impacting voter sentiment, potentially. While Trump won historically Democratic, heavily Hispanic border counties in the Rio Grande Valley in 2024, places like Starr, Hidalgo, Cameron counties.
Right. That was a big shift.
It was. But now there are signs that Hispanic voters are souring on Trump due to concerns over high prices and the economic impact of his immigration policies. This makes the GOP's redistricting strategy, which we'll discuss next, maybe a bit of a risk, as Trump's support didn't necessarily translate to down-ballot Republican victories in those areas.
That's a really interesting dynamic. How do you reconcile the desire for border security with the human cost of these policies? What is the long-term impact on your community and the national political landscape when economic anxieties collide with immigration enforcement? These policies have far-reaching and complex consequences.
Indeed. Speaking of the national political landscape, let's look at some significant political power plays happening right now. Texas Republicans, emboldened by President Trump's strong performance among minority voters, have enacted a redistricting plan explicitly aimed at benefiting their party in the upcoming 2026 midterm elections. This seems to be sparking a strong reaction.
It is. This is a clear escalation of partisan gerrymandering, no question. Texas State Rep. Todd Hunter explicitly stated the plan's goal was to help his party. And in response, California Governor Gavin Newsom is preparing to retaliate. He's pushing a referendum to redraw his state's congressional maps in Democrats' favor. He's signaling a fight fire with fire approach, calling it necessary to combat efforts to subvert democracy.
Fight fire with fire.
Yeah. Analysts like Matthew Klein of the Cook Political Report are evaluating how these proposed maps will shift the balance of power in Congress. It's particularly interesting given that changing voter sentiment we just discussed in heavily Hispanic districts that Texas Republicans are targeting, districts currently held by Democrats like Henry Cuellar and Vicente Gonzalez.
So we have this battle over electoral maps, but there's also a noticeable increase in security measures in Washington, D.C. Can you elaborate on that?
Right. In D.C., the Defense Secretary has authorized National Guard personnel to carry arms. This marks an escalation in the administration's efforts to enhance security and crack down on crime in the Capitol. The stated mission for the armed guardsmen is to protect federal assets, provide a safe environment for law enforcement officers to make arrests, and deter violent crime with a visible law enforcement presence. Importantly, they won't be making arrests themselves, according to the report.
Still, armed military presence.
It's significant. It echoes Trump's activation of the Guard back in 2020 during the George Floyd protests. And it definitely raises questions about the increasing role of military forces in domestic policing.
How does gerrymandering impact your representation and the fairness of your elections? And what are the broader implications for your civil liberties when armed military personnel are deployed in your nation's capital? These are fundamental questions about democratic integrity and public order.
Absolutely fundamental.
Now, onto a story that feels like it's ripped from a political thriller, really. FBI agents recently searched the Maryland home and downtown D.C. office of John Bolton, former Trump National Security Advisor. This is part of an escalating, quote, years-old probe into his handling of classified information. What are the implications being drawn from this move?
Well, the timing and the history here are key. Bolton, of course, is a prominent Trump critic. They clashed heavily during his tenure over Iran and North Korea policy. And he later wrote that critical book about his White House experience, which Trump tried unsuccessfully to block. So this raid is widely seen as, well, vindictive is the word used in the journal. It suggests the process itself might be the punishment. FBI Director Kash Patel's cryptic tweet, "No one is above the law," sent around the time of the search, only intensified speculation about political motivation. Attorney General Pam Bondi also posted that America's safety isn't negotiable. The article suggests that in Trump Tuesday, the president's minions aren't acting as a check on his worst impulses, leading to an unchained presidential id. It implies a weakening of institutional safeguards.
And what are the personal consequences for someone like Bolton in a situation like this? He's already been critical.
Right. This highlights the significant cost for critics. Bolton has apparently been forced to pay for his own personal security for some time, and now he faces substantial legal fees, causing anxiety for his family. This is despite the fact that his book had undergone an extensive pre-publication scrub for classified material under the previous administration. The investigation into his book had faded under President Biden, but seems to have been revived now.
When former high-ranking officials face federal scrutiny, how do you ensure the investigations are impartial and not driven by political animosity? What message does this send to those who might speak out against an administration? It certainly could create a chilling effect on dissent and whistleblowing.
It's a serious concern for checks and balances.
Let's shift gears to some pressing education debates. First up, Florida. Under Governor DeSantis, the state has moved swiftly to protect Jewish students on campuses, using the framework of the Stop Woke Act. This directs public universities to facilitate transfers for students facing anti-Semitic persecution. Florida International University, for example, now requires anti-Semitism education at orientation. The state also clarifies that anti-Zionist speech denying Jewish people a right to live in their homeland is considered anti-Semitism, subject to conduct rules. What's the core debate Florida is navigating here?
Well, Florida is grappling with that really delicate balance between free expression and creating a safe, inclusive environment for all students. Their approach, as outlined, aims to protect viewpoint diversity while attacking what they call the machinery of ideological control. They're specifically targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI preferences, in faculty hiring and requiring more accountability for tenure. It's worth noting Florida has been ranked number one in the country for higher education for 8 years running, according to the journal. But this approach definitely sparks a critical discussion on how universities should balance these competing values.
Then there's the contentious issue of equitable grading. A Fordham Institute report reveals that 81% of teachers find no zeros policies harmful to academic engagement. Similar sentiment against eliminating late penalties. What does the strong opposition from teachers tell us about academic standards?
The strong opposition from teachers highlights a really significant concern that attempts to level the playing field might inadvertently lower academic rigor. Teachers overwhelmingly desire high expectations for everyone, according to the report. They view equity grading as potentially masking failures, which makes it harder for parents to assess their children's struggles and for college admissions to rely on GPAs.
Yeah, so some quotes.
The quotes are telling. Most teachers can't stand the gifty 50, referring to giving 50% for no work, and A grades are passed out like Halloween candy. This has profound implications for student preparedness and, frankly, the integrity of academic credentials.
Finally, let's look at China's Gaokao system, their intense college entrance exam. This system profoundly shapes Chinese society, dictating access to a five-tier higher education system, with top scorers becoming actual celebrities. What are the societal implications of such a high-stakes testing culture?
Well, the Gaokao system really illustrates a kind of zero-sum competition. It drives intense, costly family investment in tutoring and even housing in top school districts. The journal mentions a 550-square-foot apartment in a prestigious Beijing school district can cost $1.2 million. That's a higher price per square foot than Palo Alto, California.
Incredible.
It is. And while the government has tried to tackle inequalities, they outlawed tutoring back in 2021, demand persists, often driven underground and becoming even more exclusive. The system's teaching-to-the-test approach can hinder creativity, critical thinking, and social skill development, which are arguably more vital than ever in our AI-driven world. It's a striking contrast to educational philosophies focusing on broader skills.
How might these policy choices impact your children's education or your own academic pursuits? Are we seeing a global shift in what we value from our educational institutions, and what are the long-term consequences of these different philosophies? The contrasting approaches in Florida, U.S. grading debates, and China offer a lot to consider.
Definitely different paths being taken.
Let's turn to personal finance, specifically the true cost of parenting. Raising children is, of course, a gift, but it's also increasingly expensive. The cost of goods and services for a baby's first year has risen to $20,725 in 2025. That's up significantly from $15,775 just back in 2022. New parents often find themselves surprised by the actual expenses, making impulsive 3 a.m. Amazon orders for things like, you know, a $75 swaddle system their child barely used. But there are also smart money moves to be made, right?
Absolutely. The key insight here is that while the costs are definitely soaring, proactive financial planning can significantly offset these burdens. Parents can find, as the journal puts it, discounts everywhere by thinking like tax pros and utilizing various tax breaks and saving strategies. This is especially true with changes from a new tax law. This proactive approach can make a real difference in managing those unexpected and expected expenses.
Can you highlight a couple of the most impactful tax advantages parents should be aware of?
Certainly. The new tax law expands benefits, so planning is crucial. For instance, the child tax credit is now $2,200 per child if you're eligible. Then there are 529 college savings plans. They've been expanded to cover things like standardized test fees, tutoring, even certificate programs. Critically, K-12 private school expenses now qualify for up to $20,000 a year in tax-free withdrawals. That encourages early savings and offers real flexibility.
$20,000 for K-12, that's significant.
It is. Also, don't overlook education credits like the American Opportunity Tax Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. Billions apparently go unclaimed each year due to complexity, especially for those with MNGI above certain thresholds.
And for childcare, which is a massive expense for many, what are the smart moves there?
Well, workplace-dependent care spending accounts and tax credits offer ways to pay for childcare that includes day camp, but not sleepaway camp with pre-tax income until a child is 13. Even an employee benefits lawyer quoted in the piece, Ine Sosa, is navigating these complexities for her first child. And for entrepreneurial parents, there are some interesting tax hacks. Nina Sodi, a CFO, puts her children on her small business payroll for a tax deduction.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Then she encourages them to save 90% of their earnings in a Roth IRA. That allows tax-free growth and, importantly, penalty-free withdrawal of the contributions if needed later.
Clever. What about the forgotten middle in college aid? The piece mentions families who earn too much for aid but can't easily afford full price.
Right, that's a tough spot. The case of Ana Sofia Gomez Garza illustrates this. Accepted to elite schools like Brown and Cornell, but received little need-based aid. Her parents had saved, but in a taxable brokerage account, not a 529, creating a tax burden when they needed the funds. It highlights the importance of using the right savings vehicles. But beyond taxes, parents are getting creative. Using 529 gifting links for birthdays, character stickers on generic items, thrift store finds for high-end gear, inventorying school supplies, even giving teens their own checking accounts to teach budgeting.
Lots of practical tips there. Yeah. So are you maximizing your family's tax breaks?
Yeah.
What strategies can you adopt to lessen the financial burden of raising children, from everyday expenses to college planning, especially if you find yourself in that forgotten middle? There's clearly a lot of opportunity to be savvier with your money.
Definitely worth investigating these options.
Let's shift our focus to the fascinating and often contradictory trends in the retail landscape. First, a success story. Chili's. Owned by Brinker International, they posted record sales and profits, doubling net income, increasing sales by 22%. This led to, quote, beefy bonuses for corporate staff and record bonuses for managers. What's their secret?
Well, what's fascinating here is how Chili's seems to have thrived by nailing the value proposition in this economically uncertain time. They have attracted customers with aggressive value marketing, those $10.99 burger specials, for example, and a really strong social media presence. Apparently, young customers are posting videos of themselves with their food on platforms like TikTok. They've tapped into something.
Value and viral marketing, maybe.
Seems like it. And this contrasts sharply with BJ's Wholesale Club. They saw slower than expected sales growth, blaming economic uncertainty and poor weather. Their CEO, Bob Eddy, noted that shoppers across all income levels are more stressed. It really highlights that perceived value against, say, rising fast food prices is a powerful draw right now.
And then we have Target, facing its own significant challenges. Their new CEO, Michael Fiddelke, is a company lifer. But he faces skepticism from investors after the retailer posted its 11th consecutive quarter of flat or falling sales. Critics were hoping for an outsider to shake things up, apparently.
Yeah, this highlights two very different retail turnaround strategies, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Target's internal CEO choice suggests a belief that their internal culture and foundational strength specifically, a sharp focus on style and design, can drive revival. It's a gamble, though. Target shares tumbled 6.3% on the announcement.
Right. And compare that to Hooters.
Exactly. Contrast that with Hooters.
Yeah.
The bankrupt chain has a new buyer, Neil Kiefer, who plans to, quote, re-Hooterize it. His vision is to restore its delightfully tacky image, focusing on beer and wings for men, chicken strips and curly fries for families. He's even bringing back the orange shorts, though not bikinis.
Delightfully tacky. That's a branding choice.
It is. It leans heavily into nostalgia and a redefinition of its controversial brand identity to broaden appeal while still trying to navigate its past issues like harassment lawsuits. It's a very different approach to revival than Target's focus on internal strengths.
The contrasting fortunes of Chili's, BJ's, Target, and Hooters really underscore the challenging environment for many retailers, especially older casual dining chains like TGI Fridays or Red Lobster that filed for bankruptcy last year. So, how do your spending habits reflect the current economic climate? What can you learn from these businesses about adapting to changing consumer demands and staying relevant in a competitive market?
It's a constant adaptation game for these companies.
Let's dive into some sophisticated investing and tax strategies that could significantly impact your financial future. First, what's being called the Ivy League's illiquidity trap. Elite university endowments, having heavily invested in illiquid alternative assets like hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, to emulate Yale's past success, are apparently facing a cash crunch again. What's the core issue here?
Well, the core issue really is a lesson unlearned from history, specifically the 2008-09 financial crisis. These endowments hold only a small percentage in liquid assets. The journal says 2% cash, 6% bonds, 8% U.S. stocks, 16% international stocks. Two-thirds are in non-traditional holdings. So just like in 08-09, when many major investors needed cash but couldn't readily sell illiquid assets, they're facing similar issues now. Despite a current bull market, institutions like Harvard and Yale are struggling to sell private equity funds, often at a discount.
Even in a bull market.
Even now. Yale, reportedly, has been seeking to sell billions in private equity funds for over a year at less than their stated value. Harvard sold $1 billion at about a 7% discount. This highlights what one expert, Lawrence Siegel, warned about back in 2007, the deadly investor ailment of amnesia and the priceless value of liquidity.
That's a powerful lesson for individual investors as well. Don't get caught illiquid. On a more individual level, let's talk about Roth IRA conversions, especially with the recently enacted mega bill. This bill makes Roth IRA conversions more complex, but potentially beneficial.
Indeed. The fundamental rule still applies. Convert when the tax rate you pay on the conversion is lower than the rate you expect to pay when you withdraw the money in retirement. However, the mega bill adds significant complexities you need to consider now. For example, the expanded state and local tax, or SALT, deduction, now $40,000, up to $500,000 of MAGI, phasing down after that means a Roth conversion, pushing your income past that $500,000 threshold, could significantly raise the effective tax rate on that conversion. One CPA, Robert Keebler, warned it could hit 45.5% on a $100,000 conversion in that situation.
Ouch. So it's not just about current versus future tax rates anymore. There are other moving parts interacting.
Exactly. There's also a new limit disallowing a portion of itemized charitable deductions, 0.5% of MAGI. So accelerating donations into 2025 or using donor-advised funds could potentially provide shelter for Roth conversion income, offsetting some of that tax hit, and expanded bonus depreciation rules for pass-through businesses, allowing them to deduct 100% of asset costs, up from 40%, can also shelter Roth conversions without raising adjusted gross income or AGI.
AGI is key for other things too, right?
Absolutely. Beyond tax rates, other factors for Roth conversions include reducing the widow's penalty for surviving spouses or benefiting heirs who might be in peak earning years or high tax states. But while the mega bill's breaks can lower taxable income, they often don't lower AGI. And AGI affects things like Medicare IRMA premiums, Social Security taxes, and the net investment income surtax. It's definitely more complex to navigate now.
So, are you adequately liquid in your investments, or could you be caught in an illiquidity trap? And with the new tax law, is now the right time for you to consider a Roth IRA conversion to optimize your retirement savings? These are crucial decisions that require careful, personalized planning.
Definitely not decisions to make lightly. Need professional advice.
Next up, let's hit the road and talk about electric vehicles. EV road trips, once described as a nightmare of range anxiety and charging deserts, are now apparently a breeze. What's changed?
Well, what's fundamentally changed is the rapid build-out of fast-charging infrastructure across America. And crucially, it's not just for Tesla anymore. This really signals a move towards mainstream EV adoption. The journal writer, Christopher Mims, undertook two long-distance EV treks, one from LA to the wilderness, another 1,000 miles from the Chesapeake Bay to Niagara Falls, and apparently never feared running out of juice.
That's a big shift in perception.
Huge! He found that topping up an EV can actually be a better experience than gassing up, despite taking longer. Why? Because chargers are often located in convenient spots with good amenities, coffee shops, restrooms, etc. Better than standing at a smelly gas pump, maybe. However, non-Tesla drivers still face some challenges. Awkward charging cables sometimes, and a hefty premium, about 30% more if they use Tesla's supercharger stations.
So the charging experience is improving, but not perfect yet. And in the luxury segment, Lucid Motors' new Gravity Grand Touring SUV, described as a low-roof luxury van, is aiming to make EVs a segment for audiophiles. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is where luxury EVs are really innovating beyond just range and performance. The Gravity boasts a 22-speaker audio system and a cabin designed to be as quiet as a concert hall. Its exceptional quietness allows for unparalleled audio fidelity, something often wasted in internal combustion engine cars because of engine and road noise.
Right, the noise floor is lower.
Exactly. Lucid's engineers specifically sealed cavities for better bass response and developed their own amplification and spatial imaging digital signal processing, or DSP. The reviewer tested it with a full resolution title recording of James Brown's I Gotcha, I Feel Good, and described the sound as magical, like snatching a moment of the infinite past back to the tangible present. High praise.
That sounds incredible. The Gravity's design, though, with its hypersonic tadpole aesthetic, challenges the traditional boxy preference of the SUV market. It achieves a 0.24 drag coefficient for aerodynamics and a 450-mile range.
That design choice definitely raises questions about consumer acceptance. Will buyers embrace such an innovative look, even with its impressive performance specs? We're talking dual-motor all-wheel drive, 828 horsepower, 0-60 mph in 3.4 seconds. It's really pushing the boundaries of what a luxury SUV can look and feel like.
So are you ready to ditch the gas pump for an electric road trip? What luxury features would you prioritize in the next generation of vehicles, and how might these innovations reshape your travel experiences? It's clear that the automotive landscape is evolving very, very rapidly.
The future is definitely electric, but the details are still being worked out.
Let's turn our attention to the relentless march of AI, which is rapidly expanding its global reach and impacting jobs. TikTok, for instance, is laying off hundreds of its 2,500 UK content moderators. This is part of a reorganization to strengthen its global operating model for trust and safety, and crucially, to embrace AI. What does this tell us about AI's impact on labor?
Well, this move really highlights the accelerating trend of AI replacing human jobs, especially in areas like content moderation. And it's happening even though AI's accuracy and nuanced capabilities in these areas are still very much debated. The UK's Communication Workers Union specifically voiced alarm over cutting human teams in favor of what they called hastily developed, immature AI alternatives. The key insight is that AI's impact on labor is no longer hypothetical. It's actively reshaping workforces right now, and the efficacies and ethical implications are still being heavily discussed.
And in the realm of generative AI, OpenAI is making global moves. They're opening a new Delhi office, establishing a legal entity in India, actively hiring there. This comes amid that intense legal battle with co-founder Elon Musk.
Right. That ongoing legal and competitive battle between Elon Musk, who now has his rival startup XAI, and OpenAI Sam Altman, really underscores the high stakes in the race for AI dominance. Musk reportedly tried to acquire OpenAI with a $97.4 billion bid, which was rebuffed. He even invited Mark Zuckerberg to join him, apparently citing OpenAI's alleged deviation from its founding principles.
$97 billion. Wow.
Yeah, it suggests a deep conviction about OpenAI's future value, even from a rival. Meanwhile, OpenAI's global expansion reflects their drive to scale and secure talent in key markets like India. It's a battle for the future of AI leadership playing out on multiple fronts, legal, competitive, global.
Finally, in autonomous vehicles, Waymo has received a permit to begin testing a limited number of its autonomous robotaxis, up to 8 vehicles in parts of Manhattan and downtown Brooklyn until late September. They boast a strong safety record, over 10 million rides in 5 major U.S. cities already.
Waymo's entry into the incredibly complex urban environment of New York City marks a really significant step for self-driving technology. The city's willingness to grant this permit, alongside Waymo's safety record, indicates growing confidence in the technology's readiness for more challenging real-world deployment. This is happening with close coordination and data reporting with the Department of Transportation, and NYC Mayor Adams expressed pride in welcoming Waymo prioritizing street safety. The key insight here is that autonomous vehicles are moving beyond controlled environments into some of the most complex driving scenarios imaginable.
How might AI affect your job or industry in the coming years? Are you ready to trust a robotaxi in your city? And what are the ethical considerations you weigh as AI becomes more pervasive in our lives? The impact of AI is only going to grow, it seems.
It touches almost everything eventually.
Shifting to green energy, we're seeing a significant policy change in the U.S. The government has removed long-standing subsidies for solar and wind power. Those tax credits that have been in place since 1992 for wind and 2005 for solar as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Surprisingly, the renewable energy industry is expected to, quote, absorb and maybe even benefit from this shock in the long term, despite some initial short-term pain. What's the big picture here?
Well, the key insight, I think, is that the removal of these subsidies reflects a belief that the industry has matured enough to stand on its own, and that this change, while maybe painful in the short term, could actually spur greater efficiency and long-term stability for the sector. You see, those generous tax credits, as Bloomberg NEF analyst Etin Jain suggested, previously reduced the pressure to minimize costs in areas like labor and permitting. So a subsidy-free environment could spur greater efficiency and cost-cutting.
So getting rid of complex subsidies could actually simplify renewable investments, make it more straightforward.
Exactly. It could potentially open the sector to a broader range of investors who found the previous tax equity mechanisms, frankly, opaque and complex. The Bloomberg NEF report noted that no other major solar or wind market relies on any mechanism as complex and generous as the U.S. tax credits. That points to an opportunity for streamlining. Now there will likely be short-term pain. Bloomberg NEF estimates 23% fewer new installations through 2030 because of this.
23% is quite a hit.
It is. But the longer-term outlook is described as a seller's market. Why? Because electricity demand is rising for the first time in a while, actually. And that demand is fueled by the insatiable needs of artificial intelligence data centers, plus the broad shift from fossil fuels to electricity for heating, water, cars, everything. This underlying demand acts as a powerful buffer for the industry's long-term health, even without the subsidies.
Does this shift in policy give you more confidence in the long-term viability of renewable energy? How might increasing demand for power from AI impact your energy bills or your own investment decisions in green technology?
Yes.
It's a significant transition with both challenges and opportunities ahead.
Yeah, the demand side is becoming a huge factor.
Let's dive into the dynamic world of sports, where we see everything from individual brilliance to systemic challenges. First up, Paul Skeens. The Pittsburgh Pirates ace is preparing for his 50th MLB start, just 2 years after being the first overall pick in the 2023 draft. He has truly exceeded massive expectations. Triple-digit fastball, pinpoint command, that mysterious splinker pitch. Many are arguing he's having the best start to a career of any pitcher in history. What makes him such a standout?
Well, Skeens' exceptional talent really stands out as a unique force. He's a rare individual who can immediately dominate at the highest level. Talent evaluators apparently called him the most talented pitching prospect they had ever seen. But if we connect this to the bigger picture in sports, it kind of highlights a broader challenge: innovation. College football, for example, is facing what the Journal calls a big problem, a perceived lack of new innovative schemes.
Really? Seems like there are always new plays.
Well, the argument is that the gimmicks, things like the air raid offense pioneered by Helmum and Mike Leach, or Chip Kelly's warp speed attacks, the triple option, the RPO, they were once revolutionary, but now they're commonplace. Traditional powerhouses recruit the best talent, which can stifle the need for schematic innovation at the top, leaving smaller programs struggling to find new ways to bridge that talent gap. It creates a kind of innovation drought, arguably.
That's a stark contrast to individual brilliance like Skeens versus potential systemic stagnation. It's interesting how legendary Alabama coach Nick Saban, who initially griped about up-tempo offenses.
Right, he hated them at first.
Really adopted them himself to win championships.
Exactly. It perfectly illustrates the cyclical nature of strategic imitation in sports. When something works, everyone copies it, and the competitive advantage diminishes. The article suggests this fallow period in college football might precede a new storm of creativity, though. Coaches are still experimenting with radical ideas like unconventional offensive line placements, always looking for that next breakthrough.
And speaking of competition, a significant labor dispute is brewing in Major League Baseball over a proposed salary cap. Owners insist it's necessary for competitive balance, while players argue against it, claiming it would hurt lower-paid players.
Yeah, this dispute really highlights the contentious financial dynamics between players and owners in pro sports. With minimum salaries at $760,000 and top players making, $27 million, the article cites a shortstop making that much who'd driven in only 57 runs by late August. The economic arguments often fail to resonate with the public frustrated by the high cost of attending games. Think $15 for beer, $40 for parking.
Right, the fan perspective is very different.
Very different. The public often feels, as the Journal puts it, a plague on both your houses. That sentiment complicates any resolution. The core insight is that the business of sports often overshadows the love of the game, creating tension between stakeholders and fans.
As a sports fan, how do you feel about the balance between raw talent and strategic innovation? And how does the economics of professional sports affect your enjoyment of the game and your willingness to attend? The financial realities are certainly shaping the fan experience these days.
Definitely a factor for many people.
Let's delve into the rich tapestry of arts, literature, and even journaling. We have a fascinating piece on Henri Matisse's 1912 trip to Morocco. At age 42, seeking liberation from gloom and leaden skies, he produced paintings that explored color volume, exciting what the article calls near-religious devotion in art lovers. What was significant about this period for Matisse?
Well, this period was truly transformative for Matisse. He converted his hotel room in Tangier into a studio and embraced a kind of sketchiness and freedom. He produced works like Palm Leaf, Tangier, and the Moroccan Amito very quickly. It really underscores the enduring power of artistic expression and how new environments can unlock profound creativity. And this connects, in a way, to how personal collections can reflect broader cultural history. Look at Stuff, the book by Kim Haystrider, co-founder of Paper Magazine.
Ah, yes, The Hoard.
Exactly. It's described as an impressive archive of objects, artwork, ephemera collected over 73 years. It serves as both a memoir and an anthropological record of the past five seismic decades. Shows how personal curation tells a larger story.
And for classic film buffs, ready for my close-up, revisits Billy Wilder's 1950 masterpiece, Sunset Boulevard. David M. Lieben's study explores its creation, apparently inspired by silent film auteur D.W. Griffin's obscure death and its unflinching look at the toxic nature of fame and Hollywood's decay of body and spirit.
That film's iconic imagery, Norma Desmond, the body floating in the swimming pool and its timeless critique of Hollywood remain incredibly potent. Even the actors involved, like Gloria Swanson, were familiar with Hollywood's dips and swerves. In literature, we have Kate Riley's novel Ruth, offering a tenderly teasing and moving portrait of a Hutterite woman navigating her community and later a stifling marriage, told in brief time-hopping episodes.
Mm.
And for a more modern take on classics, An Earful of Austen, a new audio drama adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. It's praised for its rich theater of the mind, atmospherics, church bells, cries of tradesmen.
Immersive.
Very. But it also apparently includes some anachronistic slips and a startling bit of plain amorous activity at the end, which purists might find a departure from Austen's usual restraint. Adapting classics always involves choices.
Finally, there's a compelling piece on journaling, championed by best-selling memoirist Suleika Jawad. What's the power of this analog practice, especially in today's digital world?
Well, what's truly fascinating here is the rise of journaling as both a wellness and a community tool. Jawad, author of Between Two Kingdoms, says journaling literally saved her life after leukemia diagnosis at 22. It helped her process fears and forge deeper connections. Her Substack, The Isolation Journals, now has 240,000 subscribers. People are turning the lemons life throws at them into creativity and fostering vibrant communities in the comments section. She also leads journaling clubs. The key insight is that journaling transforms a traditionally solitary practice into a shared experience, offering therapeutic benefits and building supportive connections in an increasingly isolated world.
What role does art and storytelling play in your life? How do you find meaning in personal collections or classic works? Have you considered how journaling could help you process emotions or connect with others? What creative outlets might you explore? The power of personal expression and reflection is clearly profound.
It's a basic human need, I think.
Let's turn to some truly captivating bookshelf discoveries, spanning history, horror, and ancient worlds. First, David Baron's The Martians. It delves into the Mars craze around the turn of the 20th century, focusing on Percival Lowell. He was the guy who, through his observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, believed he saw a massive Martian irrigation system built by intelligent life. This was despite, well, evidence to the contrary, and misinterpreting Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli's canali, which just means channels as canals, implying artificial waterways.
Mm-hmm.
What's the broader lesson here?
The broader lesson really is about the power of belief and myth-making. The Martians perfectly illustrates how wishful thinking and sensationalism can shape scientific and public perception, even against factual evidence. Lowell's depictions were pure fantasy, apparently, but they appeal to a public eager to believe in Martians. It shows how easily people can be swayed when they want to believe something. And this connects, interestingly, to Professor J.C.D. Clarke's The Enlightenment. This book challenges the whole notion of a cohesive 18th century movement.
Challenges the Enlightenment itself.
Argues that the commonality was retrospectively imposed by 20th century historians, often to serve post-war ideological agendas like creating an anti-racist, cosmopolitan counterweight to fascism. It reveals how historical narratives are constructed and reinterpreted to serve contemporary values, questioning the very coherence of these grand intellectual movements we take for granted.
That's a powerful insight into how we view history. It's not always as neat as we think. And moving to an even older past, Moti al-Rashid's Between Two Rivers explores ancient Mesopotamia, Sumerian, Babylonian, Assyrian, Neo-Babylonian civilizations. It focuses on the city of Ur and its highly organized administrative state.
Yeah, what's fascinating here is the detailed look at these ancient test score-driven administrative states. It offers a surprising parallel to modern high-stakes testing systems, like China's Gaokao we discussed earlier. The book provides what are called clay snapshots of real lives from thousands of years ago. You see everything from a dog's paw prints on bricks to the legal dealings of cloistered women using female scribes. It features figures like King Nabonidus and his daughter Enigaldi Nana, who was installed as high priestess after a lunar eclipse in 554 BC, and even the world's first named author, Enheduanna. It really connects us to the intricate daily lives and sophisticated structures of these ancient civilizations.
Amazing detail. And for a story of profound human courage, Mark Yost's The Boys in the Light.
Danny.
It tells the true story of two Jewish boys, Eddie Wilner and Mike, who escaped a Nazi concentration camp hidden in the German countryside and were rescued by Company D of the 3rd Armored Division.
This is a deeply moving story of survival against unimaginable horror. It showcases the resilience of the human spirit and the profound impact of unexpected acts of compassion during wartime. Eddie was just 12 when he was sent away after Kristallnacht. He and Mike were mentored on survival in the camp by Eddie's father before he died. The book also touches on that phenomenon of Germans preferring to surrender to Americans over Soviets in 1945. It recounts one 17-year-old German, Helmut Altner, captured by Russians who offered him a cigarette and simply said, War over, all go home, adds a layer of human nuance to the end of WWII.
What historical myths or popular beliefs has your own curiosity led you to question? And how do you connect with stories of ancient civilizations or moments of profound human courage that transcend time? These books truly offer a journey through time and the human experience.
History is always more complex and more human than we often realize.
Let's turn to some interesting trends in everyday lifestyle, covering fashion, food, and home. First, fashion. Apparently, boomer leggings are out and big workout pants are in. Leggings are, quote, dead among Gen Z, who prefer loose parachute pants paired with tiny crop tops. What does this tell us about generational style shifts?
Well, it just illustrates how swiftly generational preferences can redefine style norms, right? It affects everything from casual wear to athletic apparel. Sales of fitted bottoms have apparently been falling for years, with brands like FP Movement capitalizing on this shift. Chrissy Jones, owner of Sky Ting Yoga, emphatically stated, "The legging's dead." And Free People's chief creative officer, Anna Hartle, noted a huge shift toward baggier pants. Even workout entrepreneur Tracy Anderson has long championed baggier styles. The key insight is simply that brands need to constantly adapt to these rapid shifts to stay relevant.
And for your home, there's a great piece on common house painting mistakes pros see most often. These include things like skimping on sampling colors, overlooking how the sun affects color intensity, using too many bold colors together, and not checking the weather forecast before starting.
Yeah, avoiding these common errors can save homeowners significant time, money, and frustration. Practical wisdom. Understanding how light impacts color is huge. For instance, Michael Rubino chose a duller fire engine red for his Alexandria, Virginia row house to avoid an intense and bright look in direct sun. Another pro warned against a McDonald's look with too many bold colors, and one poor homeowner, Erica Mailman, found her chosen teal looked like a municipal swimming pool on her house facade because she didn't sample properly. It really matters.
Good tips. And for culinary adventures, let's talk about the authentic daiquiri. According to New Orleans bartenders, what's the secret to a real deal daiquiri?
The secret, apparently, is using granulated sugar instead of simple syrup. Why? To avoid over-dilution and let the lime flavor really shine through. Manolito in New Orleans uses granulated domino sugar, for example. This highlights that classic tension in mixology and cooking. Traditional, often more demanding techniques that yield superior results versus modern shortcuts that prioritize convenience. Similarly, a new cookbook, Malai, offers easy recipes for kulfi pops, traditionally a slow-cooked milk confection, now adaptable with immigrant shortcuts like condensed milk. It shows how traditional dishes adapt with modern ingredients for ease.
How do your style choices reflect your generation? Are you willing to embrace new trends in fitness wear? What home improvement projects are you considering? And what culinary adventures might you try this weekend? These small decisions contribute to the fabric of our daily lives.
From leggings to lime juice, it all adds up.
Finally, let's explore some captivating travel tales, from epic family journeys to scholarly adventures. WSJ readers shared truly memorable family travel moments. Watching the moon landing in 1969 at Lake George, life-changing trips to Moab, Grand Canyon adventures that taught life lessons without scars, 20 years of cabin retreats in Minnesota, a Sunday surprise drive, rainbow sightings in Yellowstone after a father's passing, a roadside community sing in Canada, a competitive family Olympics in Denver, an Alaskan cruise that helped a couple rediscover us, and even a Lord of the Rings-themed Kansas road trip where they spoke tree language and taped Frodo to the dashboard. What's the overarching theme from these diverse experiences?
Well, what's really fascinating is that these diverse stories underscore that the most memorable travel isn't always about luxury or flawless logistics, is it? The key insight is that the most impactful travel experiences are about creating lasting memories, fostering connections, and learning life lessons through shared adventure, and sometimes even adversity. It's about those unique moments that knit families more closely together.
And for the intellectually curious traveler, university extension programs offer immersive, non-credit, scholarly travel courses. Destinations like Oxford for Dickens or Celtic literature, Athens, Thessaloniki for Greek texts, Dublin for James Joyce, even Madagascar for lemurs and chameleons, or Cuba to study politics and economy.
Yeah, these programs like the University of Utah's Go Learn program to Cuba, led by Professor Al Campbell, or Harvard Alumni Travels to Central Asia's Stans, they demonstrate a growing trend of learning environments that combine tourism with intellectual engagement. The key insight is that travel can be a powerful tool for personal growth, offering deeper understanding and purpose beyond just sightseeing. These trips connect you directly with experts while exploring.
And for more practical travel, there are smart beach packing tips from travel pros. Using multitasking totes like the classic L.L. Bean Boat and Tote or the Yeti Camino, versatile Turkish towels that dry quickly, watertight pouches for wet swimsuits.
Right. Those practical hacks highlight the importance of planning and adaptable gear to reduce stress and enhance enjoyment. For example, waterproof Kindles for reading without screen glare, sleek water bottles like the Owala FreeSip, and when road tripping with teens, tips include giving them autonomy over music, food, stops, doing research on interesting local spots like finding that restaurant in Kingsland, Texas that was once the house in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
No way.
Yeah. And critically, avoiding critical comments on their driving. This emphasis on respecting their preferences can turn a potentially tense journey into a bonding experience.
And for golf enthusiasts, there's a guide to lesser-known historic golf links in Scotland, beyond just St. Andrews. Places like Moray Golf Club, Spey Bay Golf Course, Cullen Links Golf Club, and old Tom Morris original from 1870 with sea stacks.
Right, this offers a more immersive experience in the game's traditions and local culture, moving beyond just trophy hunting at the famous courses. And for solo travelers, there's an account of a journey to Crete, inspired by Henry Miller's writings. Exploring ancient sites like Knossos, picturesque towns like Agios Nikolaos, the historical leper colony of Spinalonga, focusing on the island's natural beauty, cuisine, and timeless sensual pleasures. It showcases travel as a personal quest for inspiration and connection.
What travel experiences have profoundly shaped your family or your personal outlook? How might you plan your next trip to be more immersive, meaningful, or simply more enjoyable, whether it's a scholarly adventure or a beach getaway? The world is vast and the possibilities are endless.
So many ways to explore.
Wow, what a deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, August 23rd, 2025. We've traversed everything from global economic shifts and high-stakes political dramas to the deeply personal costs of parenting and the unexpected joys of, yes, middle-aged skateboarding. It's truly a testament to the myriad ways the world constantly evolves around us.
Indeed. What's truly fascinating, I think, is how interconnected these seemingly disparate stories actually are. They reveal deeper patterns when you look closely, whether it's the ripple effect of Fed policy on your daily budget, or the subtle shifts in consumer preferences impacting major retail chains, or even the profound human stories that remind us of our shared vulnerabilities and resilience. It all boils down to understanding patterns and anticipating implications. And this raises an important question, I think. In an increasingly complex and interconnected world, what responsibility do you feel to stay informed? And how does this knowledge empower your decisions, both big and small?
A powerful thought indeed, and one we hope you'll continue to ponder long after this deep dive concludes. Thank you for joining us on this exploration of the insights from today's Wall Street Journal. We hope you feel more informed, more curious, and perhaps even a little inspired. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and keep making those connections.